Case number 075347. Ari Zivotofsky, MBZ, by his parents and guardians, and Naomi Stegman Zivotofsky, MBZ, by his parents and guardians, appellants versus Secretary of State. Mr. Lewin for the appellants, Mr. Yellen for the appellee.
May it please the court. Today, quite coincidentally, happens to be the sixth birthday of the plaintiff appellant in this case. He was born on October 17, 2002. And a little less than 3 weeks earlier, President Bush signed a bill that had been enacted by the Congress, which gave him what this court, in its original initial view of this case back in 2006, viewed as an individual right that he had standing to enforce. And that was the right, through his parents, to have his passport say Israel if he was born in Jerusalem.
Does the record show why he wants his passport that way?
Yes, the record does show, Judge Williams, through an affidavit from his parents, that they feel for reasons of both religion, social identification, that their child wants to be indicated as having been born in Israel. They emigrated to Israel. They are dual nationals, born in the United States, very proudly retained their American citizenship, and under the law have also become citizens of Israel. There is an affidavit in the record from the parents explain why they wish to have the passport read Israel and not just Jerusalem.
Where is that?
Page 25. Of the joint appendix, Your Honor. I guess it's his mother's declaration executed on January 30th, 2004. And in paragraph 7, she says, "My husband and I took permanent residence in Israel in 2000 while retaining our American citizenship as part of our religious belief that Jews should live in Israel, which is the Jewish state." In paragraph 8, she says, "We respect and appreciate America and the democratic principles for which this country stands. We treasure and value our status as American citizens. But in addition," she says, "it is important to us as a matter of conscience," this is paragraph 9, "and we believe it will be important to our children that if born Israel, they be recognized as natives of Israel and that the country of birth not be erased or omitted from their travel documents or from their official certificates of birth."
It doesn't exactly explain why she attaches value to a U.S. document identifying Israel as his place of birth.
Well,
I mean, I take his parents are free to tell everyone in the world he was born in Israel. We're very proud of that. I mean, it seems to me the goals set for here can be satisfied without a change in the passport.
Well,
except to the extent that, I mean, she wants the passport changed, but exactly what that adds to what is already historical fact is unclear.
Well, I guess, to the extent passport is used a means of identification, even as an alternative to driver's licenses, frequently, even if it can be shown in the United States or in other countries, it shows that this is an individual who is a citizen of Israel, not just of some city that is not necessarily associated with it. And then let me say also, Judge Williams, that very question, I think, is what Congress decided. If Congress said you have the right,
so whether we get that depends on some other thing, right?
First, certainly depends,
question,
on, depends on other things.
First, whether the statute precatory, second, the political question doctrine, and third, the constitutional issue.
Sure. But my point just is that apparently Congress said we recognize that American citizens who were born in Jerusalem would want to identify in this travel document when they cross borders, when they should for identification, as citizens of Israel. Therefore, we give them that right. And I don't really think that relates to issues as Your Honor has said, are really presented by this case or by this appeal. We submit that basically there are a number of reasons why the district judge's decision that this is a political question are wrong. First of all, nobody asked the district court to issue, to decide a political question.
That seems to be a fascinating thing about the political question doctrine, how you identify the question. And let me just present to you a possible approach. The political question doctrine enables a court to avoid a question, right? Presumably, the only point of it is to avoid a question which the litigation would otherwise require it to decide. As I see it, there are only two questions that the litigation requires us to decide apart from the political question doctrine. One is precatory versus mandatory, and the other is constitutionality. I don't honestly see how the precatory mandatory thing is a political question. Is that a correct formulation of that, identifying the question to be classified as political or not political?
That is a correct, not necessarily precise formulation that we had, but nonetheless we think that that correctly states it, because to the extent the political question doctrine says that courts should not be deciding political questions, but the political branches of government should, in this case, a political branch of government has decided the question. It has
another political branch decided another answer, right?
But the court is not thrown into the middle of it. I mean, that's why we submit Baker and Carr is quite relevant, because Baker and Carr is a case where the parties and come to court and say, we want the court to decide.
The court's not thrown to it until you bring your action here, right? I mean, the nature of the political question doctrine is that you have someplace else to go to get the relief you want, but you may not go to court. Now you would recognize that 214D is in direct contravention of the executive's policy, correct?
It's in direct contravention of a policy that the executive has announced that we say was wrong from the time it was initiated and continues to be
there's
wrong.
There's no question it's a statement of foreign policy by the executive, right?
No, Your Honor, with all respect, right, we do not agree that the statement of whether the passport identification should say Jerusalem or Israel is a foreign policy question. We submit that is an issue of identification of the individual passport holder.
The executive has made the judgment that this is a contentious issue that has consequences for American security interests abroad, right? That's their reasoning. You may disagree with it, but that's the reasoning. Now there can be no dispute that, in fact, this is a contentious issue, correct? If the United States were to take a position on the status of Jerusalem, it's a contentious issue, right? And the executive has decided more than 50 years that this is something they want to stay away from.
Yes. What we said, Judge Griffith, is that the identification in the passport is not a statement of what Jerusalem is Israel. It is a statement by the passport holder where he or she wants to be identified having been born.
Who makes the statement in the passport? Whose statement does it belong to?
The applicant makes that statement, just as the applicant makes the statement.
That's not right, Mr. Lewin. The statement is being made by the United States.
On the basis of the applicant's statement, all these exceptions under which the State Department says, well, applicant, if you don't want Israel in your passport, we won't make you say Israel in your passport. The indication, therefore, is that State Department is not saying we're making an independent judgment as to where you were born. We're prepared to go along with what you want if you strenuously object to Israel, or we won't put Israel in your passport. The indication, therefore, is that it's the applicant who is making a very central judgment with regard to how he or she wants to be identified.
But now, I think Judge Wood's question suggested, at least to me, there's nothing preventing the family, the applicant, from declaring to the whole world that he was born in Israel. The issue here is whether the United States government will be part of that expression. And the passport is clearly a state by the United States government to the world regarding the individual.
In response to that, might I say, Judge Griffith, that the reason why this change might make a difference is because the State Department several years ago decided they were not going to allow people born in Jerusalem to indicate Israel. If they now make a change, then that original policy, they say, will be, because of the change, will be viewed as a change of attitude regarding the status of Jerusalem. We say that's simply wrong. Look what happened with Taiwan. With Taiwan, the United States said Taiwan is part of China. We will not recognize Taiwan as being independent.
What happened when 214 was enacted?
No, Your Honor, if Your Honor will look at the cables, the original cable, and they appear in the joint appendix, in the rear of the joint appendix, the original cable is from the Secretary of State in Washington. We understand that despite our efforts at clarification, media and public in many Middle Eastern Islamic states continue to believe that the state authorization bill signals a change in U.S. policy towards Jerusalem. Of course, it's possible. From the State Department, they're sending out a note saying, look, we understand that people are opposed and are upset because a change of what we did years ago is now going to be viewed or may not be viewed as a change in American policy.
I'm not sure I understand why you think Taiwan example gets you anywhere. It was not inconsistent with U.S. policy at that time. The U.S. recognized Taiwan as part of China, and so a statement of birth in Taiwan was not consistent with the U.S. policy.
I'm sorry, Judge, I think it was, because they recognized Taiwan as part of China and therefore refused to allow Taiwan to be the location designated on a passport. Along comes Congress and says, even though, State Department, you do not recognize Taiwan as being independent, people who want Taiwan to be independent will be allowed to put Taiwan on their passport. That's contrary. It was squarely contrary.
Under the political question doctrine, we review the consistency of the executive branch from one foreign policy issue to another.
No, Judge Wilms, that's not our argument. Our argument simply that Taiwan point goes to the fact that this is an overblown and exaggerated response to what Congress has done.
That sounds like, and to the extent that you rely on the Taiwan situation as a in support of that argument, it appears to be essentially a demand judicially enforced executive branch consistency.
What we're saying is that court should look with some skepticism at what the State Department says is going to be some enormous reaction and because of change in what's in a passport.
I think just the sort of thing that political question doctrine enables us not to get into.
That's Baker factor two explained in a better way than I've ever heard explained.
Let me weigh in on this, because I think you haven't answered the question directly. The government couldn't respond to what you offered on the political question, because my own view, because I'll ask them, is that the political question doctrine is nonsense. It has nothing to do with anything. This is merely a legislation Congress has passed, and we're supposed to determine its constitutionality. Now, you have questions that are serious questions on its constitutionality as to whether or not there's an intrusion on an express right of the executive to recognize foreign states. But I thought your answer on the, I mean, Japan whaling, they can't answer. They throw it in a CF citation in their brief. They have no answer on Japan whaling. The Supreme Court blew away and said that's not what the political question doctrine is about. This is interpretation of a statutory provision for its constitutionality, and comes to us all the time. U.S. Pink is a case where you'd lose under their reasoning on the constitutionality, but never cross to the court that there was a political question kind of issue. Isn't that what your argument is there? There's nothing here on the political question.
Correct. That's exactly right. Our view is, and that's why we did not have the Baker and Carr standards. We didn't discuss them because we think...
It would drop the caseload of the federal courts in these areas rather dramatically if we apply political question to all these kinds of cases where all we're doing is construing the constitutionality of a congressional statute.
Right. Now,
the big problem you have is if you go to the constitutionality, because I think this precatory mandatory is silly, and the government, I can't believe they wasted the time on that one. The heart of this case seems to me is whether or not Congress could constitutionally adopt the provision that he did when you have express recognition on behalf of the executive control all matters relating to the recognition of foreign states, which is a sweeping U.S. v. Pink, to come back to it again. The court said what government to be regarded here as representative of a foreign sovereign is political rather than judicial question be determined by the political department of the government in the hands of the executive. That authority is not limited to a determination of the government to be recognized. It includes the power to determine policy, which is to govern the question of recognition, which to me assumes all of what you're arguing about.
Well, let me explain why. I was astounded when the district court relied on the recognition of foreign sovereigns. It's clear that this rule is not a recognition of foreign sovereigns rule. The State Department
intrudes on the right of the, here's the issue. I understand what you're saying. As a practical matter, it seems de minimis to you. It's like this is all about nothing. The executive response is it intrudes on the prerogatives that are ours alone to determine how, as Pink says, to play out the policies relating to recognition. We don't want to announce by the giving of passports anything inconsistent with our view that Jerusalem up for grabs.
At same time, the State Department says we're issuing passports that say West Bank, Gaza, Palestine, all areas that they recognize and they admit in their deposition and admissions are not sovereign states. This is not, unless one says that everything the State Department does with regard to passports.
But wait, those areas are not in debatable geographic areas. I mean, they're not.
But they're not recognizing. This is not the this is
words,
not the power.
It's the same thing to give me those examples because the person born there is either there or Israel, and the U.S. doesn't disagree with that.
No, but it does indicate that what that line of the passport says is what the applicant wants it to say. It's not what the State Department officially recognizes
surely
as being the location.
Surely you don't mean, I've been filing as you keep making that argument, surely you don't mean to suggest that a U.S. citizen has the right to have anything put on his or her passport.
Of course not.
Okay, so that puts us into the reality of foreign relations. The person born in Jerusalem can't say, I want to have Paris listed on the passport.
Of course not. That's false.
Right.
I'm not talking about something that's outright false. I'm talking about.
So we're winnowing down now.
I'm saying if it's true, you're allowed to say what you want with regard to how to identify it.
That's the debate. And the question is it true? In the minds of the U.S., it is not true that the appellant was born in Israel because Jerusalem, in the State Department, not my view, in the government's view, the executive's view, is a debatable issue. We're not giving that question up. That's exactly the point. What's true here?
Yes. And what Congress said is it is, and the point is in the western part of Jerusalem. Again, this is a bey who was born in an area that is undisputedly appropriate in terms of recognition of Israel in the past. So that is therefore a true state, says Congress, with regard.
That's the point, says Congress.
Yes.
So the constitutional issue is, can Congress say that? That is, make that policy declaration when the executive under the recognition laws has said, no, that we're not buying that. And that's not your prerogative. You can't weigh in here.
Well,
that's what this case is about.
I hear what you're saying. Let me say, because my time is running out. The other point, I think the court can look at that and say you can't claim you're recognizing foreign sovereigns when passports don't have recognized foreign sovereign identification. But beyond that,
let me ask you. I might have missed it, but I didn't notice in your brief any discussion of Williams versus Suffolk Insurance Company. It's an old case, 1839, but it has language in it that I think is very difficult for you to avoid. I quote, and this is from the red brief at 5 and 6, when the executive assumes a fact in regard to the sovereignty of any island or country, it is conclusive on the judicial department. Now, if that is still good law, How is this not a political question? That's as clear a statement.
I would ask, how is it not an unconstitutional enactment? Not a political question. How is it not unconstitutional?
Take the political question one first, and then.
I can address that in a moment because I just want to leave one other point, okay, which I think is essential, which is that if it were unconstitutional, we submit the president had the duty to say, I view it as unconstitutional, and veto it. He signed it.
Do you have any cases supporting that proposition?
There have been no cases concerning the signing, but the whole theory
the
of
is the, president
the line item veto case and the
wait. Where does argument get you? The president can sign provisions a court subsequently finds to be unconstitutional. It's of the moment one way or another. That doesn't make it less unconstitutional because the president signed on.
It prevents him from saying that.
Oh, we don't.
Let's
forget. We don't care what he did. The question, it seems to me, is, in my view, the question is this provision constitutional? I don't care whether the president added a note or didn't add a note. That seems to me to lend no weight whatsoever to the question as to whether or not we have a constitutional provision left.
If the president viewed it at the time he signed it as unconstitutional and had sent back to the Congress might very well have come back with a record that would have persuaded you that this is a legitimate passport regulation, not foreign policy. It's passport regulation.
Mr. Loon, isn't it one possible answer to the question that you might want to consider is that when the president signs, his duty then is to enforce.
Correct.
He has a choice.
Correct.
If he's not going to enforce, he vetoes.
Vetoes. That's,
but if he signs, it triggers a duty to enforce. That's
precisely the argument that we make.
Anyone
that
who is adversely affected by it may come to court and say, it's not constitutional. The premise underlying the statute is not constitutional. We don't care if the president signed.
No, but it's the president who's come to the court and saying it's not constitutional. And the president under the Constitution has the duty to enforce the law. Or, if he thinks the law is not constitutional, as Your Honor says, to say, I'm sending it back to Congress. Let Congress override the veto, or let Congress change the law.
There's case law, as Judge Williams asked you, that says it, where we're in an area where the fight is about the alleged authority of the president or the executive branch to act, not interference by Congress. The president loses unless the president vetoes?
No, I don't think there's any authority that says that. But the veto, the line item veto cases, and say that this is a very carefully structured constitutional arrangement under which the president is supposed to return to Congress any law that he said, I cannot, I have to veto.
I'm sorry, does the line item veto case spell out the consequences of the president signing a statute?
No, Your Honor, I can't say it does. There have not been cases involving these signing statements, but we sent the court as a supplement two signing statements that the president issued just 3 days ago, and the newspapers report that President Bush has done it almost twice as...
I don't see that has... I know it has a great political resonance, but I don't see it has any legal significance whatever.
Well, we think it's legal significance the fact that we think it indicates that prior presidents thought that the system that the Constitution provided for vetoing bills if they thought it was unconstitutional was the route that should be taken.
The sole route.
Pardon?
The sole route.
I submit that...
My recollection is that Roosevelt said in connection with one of the New Deal Act that Congress should pass it regardless of its constitutionality, and we'll see what the courts say. Seems totally inconsistent with what you're saying.
Well, but that's when the president is enforcing the law. Here, the president is...
I don't think history is going to be your best argument here. Could you answer my question about how Williams...
Well, I think the difference is, and I have to admit, Judge, I have not read the case, but I think the difference is that when you're talking about really sovereignty, can the president say, this is the ambassador from such and such country. I will recognize such and such country. Yes.
That's not what the case is about. You ought to read the case. It's a case about the Falkland Islands in Argentina. It's a long battle here. But the decision was made that the United States had a view as to who's sovereign over that territory. It was disputed by called the country of Buenos Aires, and the Supreme Court said clearly that the executive's decision here controlled. The executive gets to decide where sovereignty is recognized or where it's not. And as the language is, it is conclusive on the judicial department. Now, if that's a good law,
that's precisely the point. If I might, two things. A, I think it does make the point that the issue though was sovereignty. Who is sovereign over the particular area, and court and State Department says...
That's the issue here? Who's sovereign over Jerusalem?
I'm sorry. I am not saying this is not a case that's requiring the State Department to say that Jerusalem is part of Israel. We have not asked that relief. We've said the passport... Congress has enough authority over passports to be able to say that the person who holds a passport should be able to say that I was born in Israel if he was born in Jerusalem.
The president doesn't need congressional authority to issue passports, does he?
The Congress
if there was no congressional activity, the president could issue passports. Isn't that correct?
Historically, that's true. Yeah. Theoretically,
the Passport Act recognized that, right?
Correct. But there have been acts that related to passports, to who passports could be issued. If Congress said on a passport, we don't want date of birth to appear on a passport, I think Congress would have that authority.
See, the problem that you just stated proposition and raised the question in, that an individual should have the right to state truthfully the place of birth.
Correct.
That's the question. It isn't clear what's truthful here, if you look to see who has the authority to determine whether or not Israel includes Jerusalem. The case law appears to support the proposition that that's the president's call. And therefore, your proposition isn't persuasive on its own terms, because it is truthful as you see it, and it's probably truthful as a lot of people see it. But if we're looking at our legal structure, What's truthful here appears to be what the executive branch said is or is not. And right now, the executive branch is unprepared to say that Jerusalem is indeed a part of Israel.
Well, we think Congress did have the power to say that for purpose of the passport, that is truthful. For purposes of passport, again, Congress is not saying the executive, you have to recognize Jerusalem as being in Israel, and we don't argue they can. May I just ask that, with regard to the case that you've cited, Judge Griffith, may I have the opportunity to submit something in writing within 10 days, just to, after I read that case to...
Well, Williams is cited in a government brief. It's not...
I know, but I don't think it's cited specifically for
that. Yes, it was cited four times.
One of their principal cases.
Right.
We'll give you some time for rebuttal, Mr. Lewin, since we've taken up your time. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Lewis Young from the Department of Justice. With me at council table is Douglas Letter. We're here from the, as I said, from the Department of Justice, presenting the Secretary of State. I recognize that the concerns that Judge Edwards has about the political question doctrine are threshold jurisdictional, and I'd like to address those. But if I may first, I'd like to address two very quick, discrete points, which I think I can make a brief statement on, move on if the Court has no questions about. The first is a question about the President's obligation to enforce provision that he thinks unconstitutional. That is, must the President veto a statute that contains a provision that he thinks unconstitutional or abide by it? I think we're way too far in our constitutional history for the latter proposition. I think the best source I would point the Court to is Chadha, footnote 13, the Chadha case is cited in our brief, where the Court recognizes that it is not uncommon for the President to sign bills that he believes have unconstitutional...
What's the textual authority of the Constitution for his ability to do that? There is none.
Yeah, that's I don't the think there's answer. Any. I would say, Your Honor, as a matter of 200 years
is that
of constitutional...
Part of the executive power, part of the executive power is to pick and choose which provincial...
It's not picking and choosing, Your Honor. If there is a dispute that arises about whether or not the President is faithfully executing a provision that is constitutionally enacted, that gets presented to court like this one, obviously, and the court makes a determination whether or not the President's action was appropriate. This has been the way the courts have handled questions like this for close to 200 years.
I mean, I know that we have a long history before Chadha of presidents signing
absolutely
statutes that had these arrangements in them. In that particular case, had the sitting president signed the statute at stake? I mean, that's like 200 statutes were invalidated in that decision. But
I believe this involved the congressional veto, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I believe that the president did sign the statute. I mean, that's how it's before the court.
The United States would defend it.
That may be, but the statute was enacted, right? And in any event, to the extent that there's any concern about that, I would point the court to Bowser v. Sinar, which involved the Deficit Reduction Act, which it was indisputable that the president signed the provision. The president issued a signing statement indicating that a provision of the act requiring the president to abide by an order of the Comptroller General was unconstitutional. The Supreme Court later took up the case, recognized that the president found that provision to be objectionable on constitutional grounds and held, in fact, that that provision was unconstitutional on...
The astonishing of congressional bundling...
Precisely.
...deprived the president of his right to assert his view of the Constitution.
Precisely. And I have to say, enactment of law become quickly unworkable if it was the case that the president had to veto every single law contained a single provision that was objectionable in the executive's view. There is a mechanism for resolving disputes such as that, and that's
not the only issue. The issue is once he signs, if he thinks objectionable, but he signed it. He now has a duty to enforce it. But go on.
Thank you, Your Honor. The second point I'd like to make, and I think this is a brief point as well, is whether or not the place of birth listing in a passport does implicate the recognition power. Opposing counsel argues at some length that it does not. I would simply point out to the court that Congress itself obviously thought that it did directly involve the recognition power. The title of Section 214, which contains the very provision at issue here, is called United States Policy with respect to Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I don't think we got any clear on that. The two branches, political branches, are completely in accord on that point. I'd like to turn now to the political question concern that Judge Edwards raised.
Why are you fighting it on those terms if the thrust of your argument, as I'm hearing it, is that this is an unconstitutional provision?
Well, Your Honor, as Your Honor knows, if we think there is a jurisdictional defect, we have to bring that to the court's attention. Political question, this court has held, the Supreme Court has strongly implied, is a jurisdictional threshold issue.
Strongly what? Implied, Judge?
Yes, Your Honor. The
strongly implied.
The Supreme Court.
Is it a dispositive Article III question?
Yes, this court has held that is a dispositive Article III question.
Can be dispositive. It can be dispositive.
That's the way it comes out, I suppose.
Yeah,
well, I'm sorry. It's a threshold question. As a jurisdictional question, it is a question that the court has to address before it may address the merits.
Or as you answer me, how do you explain Japan Whaling, which you did?
Japan Whaling says, and I'm quoting, the Secretary, of course, may not act contrary to the will of Congress when exercised within the bounds of the Constitution. We do not dispute. It's absolutely
that's not the language that I would point to in Japan Whaling, as you will understand.
Of course, Your Honor.
Now that you finish with a gratuitous comment, how do you deal with Japan Whaling, which says
Your Honor,
it's routine that the courts decide whether statutory provisions are constitutional.
And, Your Honor, if you want to get to the merits, if you think we're wrong, obviously we'd welcome a decision on the merits. We have a strong
the
position
problem,
on that.
The mischief and pain in all these cases involving the Supreme Court going directly to the question, it's almost borders on mundane and uninteresting in my view, to be very honest with you. You to assert political question, because the mischief is to suggest whenever the law subsumes a political type mention, political question should be involved. It's nonsense. The Supreme Court is so far away from
that. That is not our argument, Your Honor.
Well, that
nor
case,
is it
Japan Whaling
let me
absolutely clear there are a lot of political issues involved here, and is international relations involved, but we got a constitutional provision we're going to decide whether it's constitutional.
We don't dispute that, Your Honor. Let me view my pitch, if I may. The point here is that we have a provision of the Constitution, a textual commitment to the President on a particular issue of recognition. If the Constitution textually assigns to one branch of government only the authority to make a decision, the political question doctrine says once that decision is made, the courts not review it for its validity.
It's not that straightforward when you look at cases like Pan Whaling and any other cases which have involved claims of this sort, but Congress has acted, and the question is whether or not Congress has acted constitutionally.
With respect, Your Honor, there is not a case that I can think of, that I'm aware of, which involved a textual commitment of this sort. I mean, we're talking about a hook direct in the text of the Constitution assigned solely to the executive branch.
But on how to write passports?
Your Honor, on the recognition power.
Well, but that's the whole question. It's not so straightforward as their argument. I mean, their argument is compelling on that point. This doesn't leap out as a straightforward, obvious question on recognition as opposed to a fight over what can cannot appropriately be put in a passport. I understand your argument about how it intrudes in the executive's thinking on the policy question with respect to recognition, but it's not a straight-out recognition question.
I agree, Your Honor, for the following reason. Recognition power includes the power to resolve disputes about foreign territory. That's an inherent part of the recognition power itself.
What I'm saying is if you took most people in the world and said, you know, we're going to let people put Israel on their passport here, no one would realize that the executive's power had somehow been abridged, intruded upon. Or effect,
but of course,
as opposed to saying Congress has the authority to decide the Jerusalem-Israel question.
Well, it sounds like we may just have a different way of approaching.
What I'm saying, it's not a level of explicitness that Baker v. Carr seems to require.
Your Honor,
what I'm trying to say to you is I think court has said in subsequent cases we need to be very careful before we leap to reach and embrace the political question doctrine. All the court is being asked to do is to decide the constitutionality of a statute.
With respect, Your Honor, the provision here, connection to the text of the Constitution, is much more specific than it was in this court's prior political question cases. Let me just give you one example. In Gonzalez Vera v. Kissinger, the court held that there was a political question because of a textual commitment to the president to make foreign policy decisions about how and whether to support a particular government in Chile. Here, we're not talking about the general foreign policy power, which is, Your Honor, and this court knows, stems from the broad assignment power to the president in the Constitution. We're talking about the power to receive ambassadors and foreign ministers, which for 200 years of historical gloss has been the source, the textual source of recognition power and the power to decide disputes about foreign territory. For that reason, we're talking about a much more specific actual commitment in this case than we were in the Kissinger case and predecessor cases.
Is Woods v. Suffolk still good law?
Yes, it's Your Honor.
Have you got anything better more recently?
Baker v. Carr itself, I'm quoting.
I'm talking about a case that's got facts that actually deal with.
Oh, no. Actually, I'm not aware of a more recent.
You didn't cite in brief Jones v. United States, 1890 case, which I think is
I think that's the...
That's early 9th century. Yeah. So,
was that Guano Islands case, Your Honor?
I'm not sure. It says, who is the sovereign de jure or de facto of a territory is not a judicial, but a political question, the determination of which by the legislative and executive departments of any government conclusively binds the judges of that government. It sounds it may not be exactly on point, but it does certainly use the political question classification.
Yes, Your Honor, that's right.
Was the case dismissed on jurisdictional grounds or was defeated on merits of the Constitution?
I think that was actually, I think they went on to, I have to confess, Your Honor, I recall well enough to
my recollection, we can all take a look.
Yes, Your Honor.
In all these cases, I think court went on to resolve the constitutional question. They use the word, it's on the political side, meaning it's reserved to the executive. That's what we mean. But as I read these cases, the court is going on and deciding the constitutional question. They're not saying we can't even look at it. That's, I think, just great mischief in your argument there. That's not what the court has been doing in any of the cases you're citing, as far as I can see.
The mischief, if it is mischief, has a strong lineage in the first point of Baker versus Carr.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's the limiting principle, Judge Edwards. I mean,
if I saw a lot of cases post-Baker that bought your aggressive notion of that first step, I would say, you know, you're right. There isn't any great...
Your Honor, this court's case in Gonzalez Vera v. Kissinger, this court's case in Schneier v. Kissinger...
I understand you cited one or two cases. The Supreme Court has not pursued Baker v. Carr, and my recollection is they've gone opposite direction and tended not to use that approach because they do understand that it's potentially mischievous.
Well, Your Honor, citing your Honor...
The Congress here has the admitted authority to involve itself in how passports are given out. They've just been involved. No one has ever doubted
that. They only have a limited authority.
Well, that's the whole fight. That's why go-on political question seems nonsensical here, because Congress has some role to play. And so you have a situation where the two branches have roles to play. Now, one may have a larger role than the other, but they both have roles to play. No one doubts that. You don't doubt that in your brief. So now Congress enacts a law. What the court do in these cases, we decide whether the one branch is overreached in light of the authority reserved to the other branch. That's what courts do.
Well, Your Honor, it sounds like perhaps we have a different view of the scope of political question as applies in this case. We would, of course, welcome a decision.
Time on that, there's no doubt we have a difference.
Point 10, Your Honor.
Could I ask you if you agree with what I suggested earlier was the way to identify the question for purposes of the political question doctrine? I think your brief does follow that approach. How do we do it? There are lots of ways of potentially formulating the question.
I think you're right that question that would be avoided
is the
constitutional question. I think that's right. And I think more generally, Your Honor.
You do have to reach the precatory mandatory of jurisdiction beside that.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I misunderstood. No, I don't think that's right. I think if Your Honor agrees with the government's view of the political question doctrine, the way I envision the court's decision would be as follows. You would determine that there's a textual commitment to the president to make recognition determination that this case specifically challenges a decision the president has made concerning recognition, namely whether or not to list Israel as the place of birth for citizens born in Jerusalem, a city over which the United States has recognized
Suppose Congress adopted a statute having to do with squirrels in Wyoming, and Mr. Lynn's client comes in and asks for the passport to be rewritten according to his client's preferences, and the government cites the statute on squirrels in Wyoming. Wouldn't we first say, Lewin relies on that statute. Wouldn't we simply say, that statute doesn't have anything to do with this case. It doesn't help you, right? We can get into a lot of folderol about political question doctrine. Why isn't that analogous to the precatory mandatory distinction?
I see Your Honor's point. There is a certain oddity here about the government's approach, which would be the following. If we ask you, if you agree with us and you decide on the textual commitment ground, the result would there would not be an explicit holding by this court on the statute. It would only be implicit. And the reason for that, the reason you would get that result here is because the court would find that there's an express commitment to one branch of government, the executive branch, to make decisions on this issue that's presented in this case, that the executive branch...
Not necessarily. We could find that it's an express commitment to both branches of government, but it's justiciable. Something they fight out amongst themselves, and you don't go to court.
Argument. That's right. That's where you're.
That was an alternative argument, Wade, Your Honor. And I agree.
You're arguing honestly, which makes it clear what I'm trying to say, that we have to decide the constitutional issue. We have to decide what the statute means. That is precatory or mandatory? If it's mandatory, is Congress overreached? You spoke very honestly just now. The political question says to us, in some cases where the branches are at war, courts ought to just stay out of it. That's this case. Each has asserted its authority and thinks that it asserted it appropriately. Congress, on the basis of a statutory provision, it's an act. We have to now decide whether that provision is constitutional.
Your Honor, the political question doctrine also tells the courts that they should not get involved in cases, even when the branches aren't at war, but when one branch solely has authority.
You can't edit here. Just the way you answered Judge Williams and the way you answered Judge Griffith, you answered honestly. That is, we have to decide these questions. We have to decide mandatory precatory, because if it's precatory, who cares?
I disagree, Your Honor, because
Yellen didn't go along with that. That was a hypothesis I tossed out, and he really rejected it.
That's right, if I may.
But I don't like to get back to that. But I don't understand exact terms of rejection. How is it different from my squirrels in Wyoming?
Well, your squirrels in Wyoming case did have the background question, at least I understood the hypothetical, of actual commitment to the executive branch.
No, but Mr. Lewin invokes
yes.
In support of his complaint asking the State Department issue a different kind of passport.
And Your Honor, what you could do in that case, I'm sorry, I misunderstand the hypothetical. In that case, I think the court would say the squirrels in Wyoming statute makes no difference whatsoever because this is
why
our...
Why don't we say that as to the... there is a statute invoked, and it's conceivable that it makes a difference because it's just Congress whistling in the wind. But look at the statute, and it isn't Congress whistling in the wind. It's Congress mandating a particular thing.
Well, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I hadn't quite finished my
answer. Okay.
Your Honor would say that the statute doesn't matter not because of its content, but because Congress didn't have the power in this area, the executive branch,
solely. Why
would
you say that? Why would we say its content is irrelevant to what the plaintiff is looking for, because all it says is, well, I think something would be nice.
Because that's a merits determination, Your Honor. And because political question is jurisdictional, the court determines that executive
merits
branch...
determination to say the squirrels in Wyoming statute doesn't help plaintiff.
No, Your Honor. Not if the court decides not on the basis of content of the statute, but because statute is irrelevant, because the power is vested solely in the executive. That is not a merits determination.
But if we can get to that
provision's unconstitutional?
As I mentioned before, it would be an implication of the court's holding, but it wouldn't be explicit.
I want mandatory precatory to be resolved, or at least have light shed on
yes,
that.
Yes,
and at least I can envisage an opinion that says the plaintiff invokes this statute, and I suppose the statute very differently worded, suppose it really does look precatory.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't we say this statute? It just doesn't, no matter how wonderful it is, doesn't get the plaintiff anywhere near where he wants to go. I don't see how that's, I mean, I can see how the ultimate issue that the plaintiff raises, in some sense, gets into a political question. But I'm uncertain as to this first phase.
I think the court couldn't do that under Steel Co. Because you'd be interpreting the statute, and you would be, that is a merits determination. If you have, because political question is jurisdictional, if the court could, as a threshold matter, say, we know this about the world, the Constitution vests solely in the executive branch the power to make this decision, and Congress, whatever Congress does, it doesn't matter.
Okay, then back off, because now taking a position which is inconsistent with the hypothesis I offered earlier about how we identify the question to be classified as political or not.
Well, perhaps...
I theorized was it's a question you have to reach, right? And the only two questions we have to reach here are mandatory, precatory, constitutionality.
Yes, Your Honor. I think perhaps I misunderstood the original question. I don't think that the nature of the question is what determines whether the initial issue presented as a political question. Those are the questions the court would avoid addressing
exactly.
By holding on political questions.
Those
but that's not how you identify a political question. You identify a political question by looking at the Baker criteria. And if one of Baker criteria is satisfied, you don't address the further merits questions.
It's just wrong. You read Japan Railing and other case, and you're wrong on Steelco. The Supreme Court has said that. Let me finish.
Yes, I'm sorry.
You know what I'm going to say. Steelco has said in subsequent cases, Cinequan and others as well, there can be threshold terminations and not Article III determinations that a court is permitted to indulge.
Absolutely, Your Honor, Rarga, but non-merits determinations and precatory, mandatory constitutionality are merits determinations. Those are not the sort of threshold
determinations. I don't see how you make the claim that you're making with a straight face that we're not really getting to the constitutionality question by saying what this case involves. We're going to pretend the statute doesn't exist. What the case involves is something that only the executive can do. We are therefore saying, and if we didn't say it, people would think we had lost their minds, that what Congress did was unconstitutional. We would look really silly as judges to say, well, we're not going to comment on the statutory provision that Congress ordered had the right to act because they've been involved in passports forever, and we're going to pretend it doesn't exist because there's textual language which says the executive can do whatever it wants. That's really silly.
I point out, Your Honor, they haven't been involved in passports forever. It's a much more recent endeavor. We don't think it, Billy. The courts...
For us to pretend that there's no legislation...
It's not pretending, Your Honor. You expressly...
It's unconstitutional.
You would expressly recognize the existence of the legislation. You would say that...
It's unconstitutional.
Let me ask you this question that may bear on this. I've noticed every time that you've formulated a description of the political question doctrine, you've done it in terms of this is a power that's given exclusively to the executive here. As I understand the political question doctrine, that wouldn't be the only time in which it would invoke. If there was something that was textually committed to both the political branches, for them to resolve among themselves, that's another category. And why can't that be the category that we have here? It's textually committed to Congress, textually committed to the executive, and it's something for them to duke it out among themselves it's an area that we don't have the expertise to resolve.
That's an alternative.
The question is, are we called upon to resolve every dispute between the executive and Congress over textually committed powers?
I think that alternative formulation, we did make that argument as an alternative argument in our brief. The reason why I've been focusing on the first Baker factor is because we think it's unmistakably clear that the textual commitment is to solely to one branch, and that it would not be helpful, in our opinion, Your Honors, to muddy that water by suggesting that there's a joint commitment when we don't believe there is one. If the court were to disagree with us, and if the court does think that there's a textual commitment to Congress and to the executive branch, as we've argued in a brief, you're exactly correct, Your Honor, there is no standard that a court could apply to resolve a dispute between the branches in a case where there's a technical commitment to those two political branches. And for that reason, it would be a political question. I would note, however, Your Honor, on this point, that opposing counsel has not identified any textual basis for Congress's power to act here. And I would suggest that itself is fairly indicative of the history here and the constitutional basis for the executive authority on this point.
Now,
yes, Your Honor.
You certainly have helped to undermine the hypothesis that I originally offered as to how you identify.
Sorry about that, Your Honor.
No, that's fine. That leaves a vacuum. How do we identify the question which is classified one way or the other?
Well, I'm sorry I'm misunderstanding. Let me try and answer, and please correct me if you see that I've not understood your question. The case obviously presents a number of different questions.
The legal questions that would be said present are interpreting the statute and constitutionality.
And I would describe both of those as merits determinations. And political question is not a merits determination. It's largely a question about the allocation of power under the Constitution. And so if the allocation of power question can be answered in the initial instance and answered in a very definitive way, as we think it can here, the court need not reach merits question. And it would be, and Judge Edwards really dislikes this approach, but there would be an implication about the merits question, but there would not be an express holding.
Okay, so, maybe the district court identified the question as, I don't know, should we recognize Israel as sovereign over Jerusalem? That would not normally be a question that the court would resolve. Your point is that the complaint would resolve the question of recognition, and the question of recognition is a political question?
Yes, that's one way of putting it. I may put it in some different terms. The complaint here asks for enforcement of a right under a statute.
Right.
That That claim, that is, claim that he has an enforceable right, directly implicates the president's recognition power and would require the court to take a position to granting relief that the plaintiff sought here would directly undermine a decision that the executive branch, the branch that has the sole authority to make the determination at issue, has already made. And because there's a textual demonstrable textual commitment to the executive branch, the claim cannot be adjudicated. The relief that being sought cannot be given because there's no enforceable right here.
Under the Constitution, so says the Supreme Court post-Baker, one of the judiciary's characteristic roles is to interpret statutes, and we cannot shirk this responsibility merely because our decision may have significant political overtones.
And we don't.
And all that's being asked here, each side takes a different view as to whether the statutory enactment here is constitutional. What's at issue?
Your Honor, I don't dispute your point. I would just also point again in Japanese willing that the court said that the secretary may not act contrary to the will of Congress if that will is exercised within the bound of the Constitution. The political question argument we're making is asking court to make a determination about what the bounds of the Constitution are here. If the Constitution does not provide a role for Congress in determining what the United States policy with respect to...
That's the merit question. We're just going around in circles.
I think that's the jurisdictional question, Your Honor.
I hear you. Just going around in circles.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lewin, I don't believe you have any time, but we'll give you 2 minutes to give us something new.
Yes, I'll be very brief. First, let me address the case, which I have to apologize, since it was 1839, it wasn't the government's brief, but I just assumed it was stating what we certainly accept. That's what the language in it does do. It says there's no statute, and this was an insurance contract, and the question was, and I haven't even parsed through all the convoluted facts, whether a master of a ship who went to the Falkland Islands was really going in an area that was within the jurisdiction of Buenos Aires. But as to that, the executive decision is conclusive. But assume for me for a moment that Congress had passed a law that said insurance contracts, for purpose of insurance contracts, the Falkland Islands will be determined to be, for an insurance contract, within the jurisdiction of Buenos Aires. The point is, in this case, and this is the answer to my colleague's argument in response to Judge Williams, they're assuming there's no federal statute. If we came to the court without Congress having acted, yes, it would be true. Then we would be asking the court to make a political question. Is Jerusalem in Israel? And Congress doesn't say anything about it. But Congress has said something about it. And I will make another point, which I didn't make in my initial argument, but which appeared in the briefs, and I think is very important in terms of why Congress acted. Congress corrected a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, we submit, because what the State Department had been doing with regard to passports and what their policy does with regard to passports is it treats people who support Israel and believe as, I think it's so true that nobody really disputes that West Jerusalem, Shaaret Zedek, where this plaintiff was born, was part of Israel. It treats those people differently.
Sorry, no one?
Pardon?
No one?
Shaaret, West Jerusalem.
Was no one in the world?
Can't say no one in the world. I'm sorry if that's an overstatement. But I think that generally, even the State Department has sent, which doesn't want to send people to East Jerusalem, they send them to West Jerusalem, recognizing that that is part of Israel. So what has happened is people who support Israel.
Recognizing that is part of Israel. They have a sign on the person going there saying, I'm going to Israel.
But their policy has been such, and it's coming out, the policy has been such that they have said, fine, West Jerusalem is part.
Diplomats go everywhere in the world.
No, but they don't allow their diplomats to go to East Jerusalem and treat that as being in Israel. It's a distinction that they've drawn. But my point is that people who don't like Israel, by and large, Arab citizens of the United States and Israel, have an option of eliminating Israel from their passport. They can say under Department of State regulation, we don't want the word Israel to appear in the passport. Under these regulations, which they are defending, they can say Haifa, they can say Tel Aviv, and they can eliminate Israel from the passport. On the other hand, people who support Israel, by and large, Jewish residents of the United citizens of the United States, and of Israel, they are not permitted to say Israel, even though they are born in Jerusalem. Congress has said, we want to correct that. And the State Department has said, oh, we're going to fight it.
And that, we submit, is another basis for saying, in addition to the fact that we think passport regulation is something which Congress can determine, it can make all kinds of statutes regarding what a passport should say or shouldn't say, I think this is within Congress's power.
Let me just say one to make sure I understood you. Williams did not involve a federal statute, right? Is that what you just said? Williams did not involve a congressional statute?
The Buenos Aires case.
In which case? The
Williams. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yes. Yeah. No, so far as I can tell, it did not involve a statute that said that Falkland Islands are
It was just the executive, the executive's pronouncement, and someone challenged it.
Correct. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted.